This episode is brought to you in part by the American Homebrewers Association, host of HomebrewCon, America's largest homebrew gathering. Celebrating its 40th anniversary, HomebrewCon heads to Portland, Oregon, a town known as Beervana, from June 28th to June 30th. With more than 60 educational sessions, a homebrew expo to rule them all, and the legendary Club Night. HomebrewCon is an essential annual pilgrimage for homebrewers of all levels. Details at homebrewcon.org. That's homebrewcon.org. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, May 17th, 2018. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about homebrewing. This week, Chris Colby, editor of BeerAndWineJournal.com, brings us up to speed on Brut IPA. This new style of our favorite category of beer brings dry, sparkling character to the table, and Chris gives us some good tips on brewing it. If you go to BasicBrewing.com, you can find archives of our audio and video shows, our DVDs, our brewer's logbooks, and other Basic Brewing gear. And with every order, you get free Basic Brewing stickers. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Basic Brewing and find our show page on Facebook. We have a cool Basic Brewing app on iTunes and Amazon.com, and we're found all over the place where fine podcasts are served up. And if you do us the favor of rating us on iTunes and maybe leaving a nice comment, they say that'll help new listeners to find us. If you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing. This past Friday, I did an early release of the Basic Brewing video episode that we did on my 30-minute juicy rye pale ale. Financial subscribers should have gotten an email with a link to that, and I'll release that to the general public this coming Friday. Last night, I went over to Steve Wilkes' house, to record an audio show and shoot a video about the 100% Vienna Pale Ale that I brewed with hops left over from our hop sampler shows. I took a keg over there on Saturday for a party that Steve was giving to celebrate his son Chase's graduating from college, and congratulations to Chase. Well, everybody liked it so much that last night we discovered that the keg was dry, so we didn't have any beer to taste for the show. I did tell Steve that, you know, I left the keg with him, and I said it was okay if all the beer was consumed during the party, because, you know, it was mainly to celebrate Chase. But, you know, I said if we have any leftover, let's do a show. So anyway, Steve thought that there was some leftover, but we checked it, and nope, all gone. But we do have evidence that that beer was drinkable. So along with the leftover hops from the hop sampler shows, I tried hopping with an ounce of Citra Cryo hops in the keg. So there was a ton of hop flavor. I had a couple or three myself, so I got to take some credit for helping to blow the keg. I did shoot some behind-the-scenes video as I was brewing that beer. So I'll probably release that exclusively to financial subscribers. And I know at least one photograph exists of that beer in a glass. So we may just have to work with that. At least you'll know how to brew the beer. You may not see us taste it. But that's a first. I've never run out of a beer before documenting on the video podcast before. But there are worse problems, right? Last week, I introduced a new sponsor to the podcast, Poncho's Keg Cooler, with a K, from Poncho's Brewing Lab down in Texarkana, Texas. It's great. It's a 20-gallon water cooler that's specifically designed to hold and chill a 5-gallon corny keg. And last week, when I posted pictures of mine on Twitter and Instagram, a bunch of you responded, and I can see why you're excited. Poncho Lozano came up with this idea because he was tired of messing with jockey boxes, the cleaning, the keeping the lines balanced, and knowing that the keg was sitting out in the summertime heat away from the ice that was in the jockey box. Doesn't make any sense. So Poncho's solution is to keep the keg in with the ice in this big old cooler and mount a tap on the outside, and you can keep up to a 2.5-pound CO2 tank in the cooler with the keg, along with the regulator, Or you can do what I do and just run a line out to a bigger tank that is outside the cooler. It fits either ball lock or pin lock kegs and requires only a 10-pound bag of ice if your keg is already cold from your kegerator. So I used mine, like I say, for the second time this past weekend at that cookout at Steve's house. That's why one reason why all the beer was gone. It worked great. Partygoers just walked right up and poured themselves pints from the built-in tap. And I loved it. I loved the thing, and they loved it too. And even better, between parties, you can convert your Poncho's keg cooler into a 20-gallon mash tun. So it's a dual-purpose thing. So check out this cool, innovative product at ponchosbrewinglab.com. And if you use the code BBR when purchasing, you'll save $20. So remember, BBR, when purchasing, you'll save $20. And look for it at HomebrewCon in Portland. And like I say, be sure to use that promo code BBR when purchasing so that you'll save $20. And Poncho will know that you heard it here on Basic Brewing Radio. Well, speaking of Portland, remember that we take the month of June off from posting episodes to go to the conference and to take family trips and such. But we've got good stuff coming up the rest of the month of May, though, in the podcast. For instance, Steve and I did record an audio episode last night. It's our second installment of the Hop Sampler feature. This time we pitted Apollo Calypso and Experimental 07270 against each other. It was really fun to taste those blind to try to figure out which one is best and try to find out which one is which based on their lineage and the descriptions from the hop suppliers. These hops had more than twice the alpha acid percentage than the first ones that we tried. So the beers were much more flavorful and tasty. I hope you guys like that series, and I'd entertain suggestions for hop varieties that you'd like to hear us sample in that segment. I also have an interview scheduled with Dick Cantwell about his new book about brewing eclectic IPAs, and I've read it, and it's a lot of fun. If you like IPAs and if you like different flavor ideas to go with your IPAs, you need to pick that up. Lots of inspirational ideas in that. And there's one recipe that I'm probably going to brew next, a rosemary IPA. And we have rosemary growing in the garden, so I'm very curious how that would come out. Maybe we can finally do a food pairing show on the video side to sample it. We haven't done a food pairing in a long time. As you know, when I brew standard volume batches, I brew with my electric brew-in-a-bag system from our friends and sponsors, Desiree and Dave from High Gravity in Tulsa. There are a lot of electric systems out there, but the one I've got from High Gravity with the Warthog controller, I think it best fits my brewing style. You know, the sort of bread machine approach to brewing doesn't really appeal to me. But if it works for you and you get good beer, that's cool. However, I like being able to get in there and work the kettle like I always have. At the same time, I really enjoy the stability that having electricity with that Warthog controller really brings. I can dial in my mash temp in the mash mode and walk away knowing that it's going to be rock solid. No more wrapping the kettle or mash tun in blankets. No more missing my strike temp and saying, well, that's probably close enough. And no more running out of propane during the boil or having to babysit the kettle to make sure it doesn't, either the wind doesn't blow out the fire or it doesn't overheat and boil over. High Gravity has a variety of electric brewing systems that fit your needs from 5 gallons all the way up to 2 barrels, along with various Warthog controllers. And you can buy turnkey systems or just the controller alone if you're more handy than I am. Check all that out at highgravitybrew.com and use the code EBC75BB to save $75 off your shiny new electric system. EBC75BB at family-owned and operated highgravitybrew.com. Okay, Brute IPA is something that I haven't tried, but I hear that Apple Blossom Brewing here in Northwest Arkansas just got one on tap, so I need to make a business related to field trip and do some research over there. In the meantime, let's talk to Chris Colby, author of the Homebrew Recipe Bible and Methods of Modern Homebrewing, and editor of BeerAndWineJournal.com. Well, Chris Colby, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Hey, James. Thanks for having me on your show.
There's yet another IPA to talk about?
Apparently, yes.
Will this one trigger you and make you angry? Like the New England IPAs?
We'll have to see.
No spoilers.
Only time will tell, really.
No spoilers on the Chris Colby triggering aspect of the interview.
Need a safe space where... They serve West Coast IPAs.
Will you be brutalized with this new style?
Yeah.
Et tu, Brute?
Tu, Brute?
Is that where brutalized comes from? Brutus, Brute?
You know, I don't know. I don't know the etymology of that word.
Wow. Lexicographers will be emailing me on that.
Yeah.
So brute IPA, we've heard the word brute, or I've heard the word brute in association with beverages before in connection with champagne. So does brute IPA, does it have the similar characteristics to brute champagne?
Yeah, that's the reference. In champagne, there's all the different words they have to describe levels of sweetness, and brute is the driest of the wines. Although they sometimes break brut into extra brut and brut. But, yeah, basically the idea of brut IPA is a dry IPA.
And so dry meaning not sweet in wine terminology.
Yep.
So where's this come from? Who's doing this stuff?
Okay, yeah, it started in San Francisco. And the first commercial example... people are attributing it to a brewer named Kim Sturtevant at the Social Kitchen and Brewery, which I guess is a brew pub there. I don't know. So it started out in California. And after he made it, I guess a couple other people started making it. And now it's something that quite a few breweries out there are making. And people are, you know, for whatever reason... it's attracting some attention.
So it's kind of the opposite of the New England IPAs in that they are cloudy and kind of sweeter, sort of, and maybe less bitter. And it is, are these brute IPAs, could they be the arch nemesis, the bizarro New England IPAs?
Yeah, I try to think about New England IPAs as little as I can. I might not be the best guy to draw comparisons to.
Trigger
but yeah,
number one.
the basic idea of a brut IPA is that it's very dry, it's fizzy, and it's maybe not as bitter as a normal IPA, but it's got plenty of hop aroma. And the pictures I've seen of them have been, it may be a little bit less than perfectly clear because of the dry hopping, but it's not a big, ugly mess like the New England IPAs are.
So let's talk about how to brew these things. What are we talking about as far as grain bills go?
Yeah, there's a couple online interviews with the guys out there, and everyone who's brewing them basically says... you want to be mostly base malt, and you don't want to add any sort of specialty malt that's going to add any sweetness or body to the beer. So you could go with just straight a base malt, you know, any sort of two-row pilsner, that would be fine. Stay away from crystal malts, especially, or dextrin malts, because they're meant to add a little bit of body and sweetness to the beer. And, if you're just absolutely compelled not to brew a beer entirely from a single base malt, maybe just add a little bit of Munich or Vienna. You know, they aren't going to add, you know, their base malts, but they're just kilned a little bit higher, so you get a little bit more of that malt flavor, you know, that comes from the character of the husks that have been killed, but you won't get, you know, any more sort of sweetness from the carbohydrates within, because those will be dealt with in your mash.
Now, as far as fermentables are concerned, if you wanted to dry the beer out even more, could you add some, say, some sucrose, some sugar?
Yeah, sure. You could, you know, formulate a beer like pale ale strength and then add a little bit of, you know, just refined sugar, sucrose, if you wanted to. Depending on, though, one of the things people do to brew this is to add exogenous enzymes, outside enzymes, and one of them is amyloglucosidase, and that one makes glucose. So if you're going that route, I just personally, I mean, there's no rules, but I personally wouldn't add sugar on top of, you know, also adding that enzyme. But if you were not adding that enzyme and just doing like either a single infusion or a step mash, then yeah, you can.
So before we get into the mechanics of the mash, you say in the article that while you haven't yourself brewed one of these before, you've brewed beers that have some of the individual characteristics of the beer, and so you can impart some hints, you know, based on those past brews.
Yeah, I've I haven't brewed a brewed IPA ever, but back when the low carb beer was, you know, a thing, I added some enzymes to a couple beers for some tests. You know, that I brewed. And so I've done that, you know, I've done the super dry, you know, done the super dry beers. I've done, you know, highly fizzy beers, you know, both, you know, German Hefeweizens, triples, and triples actually, Belgian triple has some, very clear parallels to this style.
Yeah. It seems like a Belgian, like a strong Belgian golden or a triple, would have a lot of the same characteristics, maybe not as hoppy, you know, as a brewed IPA, but it seems like to me, you know, very light in color, very light in body, highly fizzy, sounds like a cousin.
It does sound very much like it, but I guess IPA is a sexier term than Belgian Golden right now, so. So it's a brewed IPA, not a hoppy Belgian Golden.
Yeah, hoppy Belgian Golden doesn't trip off the tongue as easily as a brut IPA. So let's talk about the mash. I mean, we've got our, you know, very simple grain bill. So how do we dry it out? What are the tricks that we can use both enzymatically and, you know, temperature and time-wise?
The first approach and the simplest would be just a single infusion mash, but do it at the low end of the saccharification range. You know, if you're in the 148 to 150 Fahrenheit range, rest that for 60 to 90 minutes, make sure to stir it a couple times, and that'll make a dry beer, especially if you only have, you know, base malts in the formulation. That, you know, that'll make a legitimately like dry, crisp tasting beer. If you want to go like a step further than that, doing a step mash would be the way to go, and a step mash where you rest, you know, somewhere in the vicinity of 140 degrees Fahrenheit, you know, maybe up to 145, but give that a rest of at least 15 minutes, if not longer, and, you know, stir the mash a couple times, and that'll make an even drier beer. But I think the big idea in brewed IPA is that's, you know, the brewers are shooting for something even drier than that. And so what they do is add outside enzymes to the process somewhere to further degrade all the, you know, quote-unquote dextrins that would not get degraded in either a single infusion mash or a step mash.
And what are these enzymes and where can we get them?
The type of enzyme that people have been using is amyloglucosidase, although there are a lot of similar enzymes. I mean, people, homebrewers, have used, you know, before Beano, which is, I forget what it is. It's like alpha galactosidase or something, but it's similar. It chews up carbohydrates. But the one people have been using is amyloglucosidase, and this is an enzyme that's similar in some ways to beta amylase, in that it attacks the ends of starch strands, and amyloglucosidase clips off one glucose residue at a time. Okay, beta amylase also attacks the ends of starch, but it clips off two glucose residues or a maltose molecule equivalently at the same time. But so anyway, in the if you add amyloglucosidase to either your mash or the kettle after the runoff, that's going to reduce any of the residual carbohydrate and potentially all of it if you add enough and give it enough time to work to glucose.
And are there commercial versions that we can buy out there easily?
Yes, there are, James.
But what? Don't answer yet. Now, how much would you pay?
Yeah. White Labs sells, there's a something they sell called Ultra Firm. That I believe it, yeah.
That's my nickname in high school.
That's what she said. Yeah, so White Lab sells something called Ultra Firm. Brewers Supply Group sells something called Amylo 300. And also, I mean, there are a lot of uses for amylo glucosidase, even outside of brewing. So there's a wide variety of people who, you know, you just Google it. There's a lot of places you can buy it from. Although, if trying to buy it in the quantity you would want at home is a little more challenging because, you know, for a lot of the things a lot of the reasons this is sold, it's sold to companies making, I don't even know what in manufacturing, but they're selling large amounts of the enzyme, you know, much more than you'd ever need in a home brewing scale.
But you don't need a 50-pound bag of amyloglyco whatever ace.
Yeah, you're not gonna need that. In fact, the dosage rate on the White Labs thing, Ultra Firm, they give it as 25 mils per 10 barrels. Okay, so and that works out to, if I did my math right, 0.4 milliliters per 5 gallons.
Wow.
Okay, so that's a small amount. It's not unmeasurably small, but it's, you know, it's like a drop or two.
You just wave the bottle over the kettle, wave the closed bottle over the kettle,
yeah,
and that's enough. So what happens if you add too much, though?
Well, that's the thing. Nothing really. I mean, it's out of carbohydrates to chew on. It's, you know, just not going to do anything. And adds a, you know, microscopic amount of protein.
So, how long does it take? I mean, say if you gather your mash and you put it in, you know, a drop of the stuff or two in your kettle and you stir it up. What temperature are you going to want to hold it at? I mean, can you denature this stuff easily? And then also, how long do you wait? And then how can you tell if it's done?
Yeah, those are good questions. And looking around on the internet, at least, I haven't found all the answers to that. It seems that most sources of this enzyme, and I mean, they may be getting this enzyme from more than one different source. Some of these are preparations from the fungus Aspergillus niger, okay, which is a black fungus that grows on fruit, and it's used widely in industry to grow up various enzymes or whatever. But some might be from other sources, I don't know. But most everything I've seen recommends something in the range of 140 to 145 degrees Fahrenheit being the optimal range.
So it'd be around 62°C, something like that.
Maybe. 62, yeah. I think that's about right. So that would, you know, if you were putting it in your mash, that would work well for the lower, for the low rest in a step mash that goes 140 to up into the sacrification range. And as for time, I really haven't been able to find a definite, you know, someone saying it takes this long, but just working on the fact that it's an amylose enzyme and, you know, you're using it sort of in the same temperature range as the mash. I would guess that, and also after the mash, all you needed to do is to work on the residual carbohydrates. You know, I would guess that 15 minutes, which should be enough. And if you're, you know, if you're absolutely worried about drying it completely out, you could let it go longer.
Yeah. So what effect, if you were looking at this, you know, over time through, say, a refractometer or a, you know, hydrometer, would you see the effects of this?
I don't think so, because, I mean, it's just converting the starch into sugar. So they're still going to have a, you know, it's still going to be one type of carbohydrate and another. And I'm not sure if that changes the specific gravity. I don't think so. And not by much. I don't think you could measure it by looking through a refractometer or a hydrometer. So you could maybe do it by taste.
Yeah, is there a danger that you could go too far? I mean, it seems like to me if you were to completely dry out your wort and turn it, you know, all into, you know, digestible sugars, that, you know, you could get it something that's really cidery and you know, like the old days when you'd add a ton of you know, just table sugar to your homebrew, you can get a cidery, you know, not too pleasant a beverage.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. I mean, I do think, yeah, if you, I mean, the idea is to completely reduce, or the idea, as some brewers have been doing it, is to completely reduce all the dextrins to simple sugars. And I would think that if you did that and your gravity was fairly high, you would have, you know, it's very dry, so it would taste thin. And, you know, I think you could, you know, you could be producing something that tastes more like rocket fuel than beer at a certain point. You know, just like some brewers, when they get to, you know, they hear that, oh, you can just add, you know, sucrose and bump up your alcohol, think, oh, I'll add a whole bunch. And, you know, you end up with problems when you try to push it too hard and you know, make too much. So yeah, I mean, that's something that people, I guess, are going to find out, how, you know, how it changes the, you know, fermentation, because you're changing, you're changing the sugar profile of the wort, so that might have some impacts on the fermentation, and that might vary. You know, some yeast strains might handle just fine. Some might have some problems with having, you know, the extra glucose. And I guess, you know, that's just something that people are going to have to find out by trial and error.
And as far as the body of the beer, you know, if it is a little thin, having it be fizzy is one way to counteract that, and, you know, kind of give the illusion of body in the beer by having a bunch of bubbles.
Sure. And another thing that I thought of is, one of the problems with enzymes is that an enzyme, once it does what it's, you know, going to do, like in the case of amyloglucosidase, once it clips off one sugar from the end of one starch, it's then active again, and it'll go do that, and it'll do that over and over and over and over. So it doesn't, you know, it's difficult to, you know, other than ballparking it, know how much add to get to like a certain level, because it can just, under some circumstances, it can just keep going and going. And you might not want that if you're, you know, if you're trying to imitate the commercial ones that are out that are completely dry, then yeah, just let the enzyme go. But you might be thinking to yourself, okay, I want to dry it out, but not completely dry. And there's a couple ways that you could do it. And I think one of the easiest would be to mash as you normally would, either do a single infusion mash or a step mash. And then if you batch sparge, run off the first, either half of your wort, or, you know, perhaps even less of that, and get that in your kettle and start that boiling. And then add, you know, along with your sparge water, add the enzyme and stir it up and let it sit for a while. And then when you run off that wort, your second wort is going to be completely dry. You know, not only will it be the second running, but it'll have, the enzyme will have acted on that. And when you run it off into your boiling wort, the enzyme will stop working because it'll be denatured by the heat.
Mm-hmm.
So you could essentially make, you know, you make your wort normally at first, run off however much you want of that, then dilute it, add the enzyme, and let that work, and then run off the rest so that you mix some normally produced wort with some enzymatically dried out wort.
So let's talk about hop schedule. It is an IPA, so one would assume that there is a certain level of bitterness and of hop flavor and aroma.
Yeah, from the descriptions of what the people in California making it are, they're trying to make it actually not very bitter, but very aromatic. And considering the drier you get, there's sort of less malt to balance out any bitterness. So that makes a little bit of sense. Although I guess you could argue then, if it's not bitter, why are they calling it an IPA? But that's I don't care about that argument, so I'm not even going to address it. But anyway, so they want it low on the bittering hops and then high on the late hops and dry hops. And I guess the original guy who brewed it went heavy on the quote unquote juicy hops, the newer ones with the tropical fruit stuff. But another guy who tried it has tried more of the traditional, U.S. floral. So you can, if you were to try it, it's at this point, it's not, there's nothing set in stone about the idea. Just experiment and find, a level of bitterness you like, a type of hop character you like. And remember that with a very fizzy beer, the hop aroma is really going to come bursting out of there if you do everything right, because the bubbles will be coming up and it should enhance whatever sort of hop aroma you have in there.
Sounds like a good something to use with a mimosa.
Yeah.
Add a little bit of orange juice in there and make it, instead of a rattler, you have a mimosa. So the kind of yeast, do you have to think about, its tolerance to the higher, more digestible sugar or fermentable sugar content?
Yeah, I think when you choose your yeast, you need to think about a couple things. First, you want it to be very attenuative. You don't want to waste all that time making a very, very highly fermentable wort only to have, only to choose, like a yeast strain that's going to leave a bunch of the sugars behind. So you want something that is very attenuative. And then second of all, any yeast strain that gets used with beers that have some simple sugars in them, that could be a good thing. Like my two choices if I were to brew this would be, I'd just either go with, 1056, the White Yeast 1056, or the White Labs WLP 01, or the, what's the dried yeast, Fermentis.
US05?
Yeah. I'd get any of those, the so-called Chico strain. I'd go with that, or there's also the strain that's supposedly from Westmall, the let's see, Y Yeast 3787. It used to be called like Trappist Ale, I think, and there's a White Labs equivalent or whatever. But that one's used to make Belgian triples a lot, and has a sort of interesting, but also somewhat typical of a lot of ale strains, that the higher pitching rate you pitch at, the more clean the fermentation is. Like there was a brew pub here for a while that made American IPAs, and they used that yeast, and you never would have guessed that it was a Belgian yeast in there, because they did, just the high pitching rate meant that it was very clean.
Mm.
And so that's what I'd do. I mean, that one is not only, it's got a high attenuation rate, but it also is used to simple sugars. And so that would be my first choice. And then the same applies to the American ale yeast, that high attenuation. It also could be used with beers with simple sugars.
And speaking of high pitch rates, I'm sure Imperial Organic Yeast also has you know, some strains that would be wonderful in this style as well. Plug for recurring sponsor. No, I love Imperial. Free plug there. Bonus. So we haven't talked about, I think we skipped over talking about original gravity and finishing gravity.
You know, if you're going to dry the beer out a lot, the higher in the original gravity is, the more it's going to be dry and alcoholic. And I think there's going to be a point where that becomes less drinkable, you know, just like I said, rocket fuel.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I would suggest sticking to either the high end of the pale ale range or the low end of the usual IPA range. Anywhere in there, the beer's going to have some kick to it, but it's not going to be overly rocket fuel-ish. And then another thing we skipped is that you don't have to add the enzyme in the mash. You can also run the wort off, hold the wort in your kettle at an appropriate temperature, and add the enzyme there too.
I think we touched on that, but it's worth repeating.
Okay.
So I mean, you know, when you say ferment dry, does that mean all the way down to, you know, 1.000
in your hydrometer? Or it'll get there or below.
Oof.
You know, if you've ever made wine,
once
you ferment all the sugars away, you've got a mixture of ethanol and water, and the specific gravity of ethanol is what? It's like 0.997, something like that. So you can actually, it can get lower than 1.000.
Yeah, I've made wine like that, and maybe a mead or two, but never beer. It's just an interesting concept to me.
Yeah, so, if I were to do this, and now that I've babbled about it in public, maybe I will. I might start off with a fairly low gravity one and not try to dry it 100% out. I mean, I might try the batch sparging trick that I mentioned, is run off half of it and start boiling, you know, and then that'd be a very dry wort already, and then make the super dry wort as a second. And mix those, and you'd end up with a beer that's drier than any step mash would produce, but not completely dry. And I think I could be wrong, but I think just even a tiny bit of residual body is going to help you a little bit.
So once we've got this, we want a really fizzy beer. So that means that we're going to put, you know, even more sugar in at priming time, you know, at bottling time, if we're going to bottle condition, which also means that we're going to have heavy glass to hold a higher pressurized beer. But then there's also challenges on the kegging side as well. So how do we handle packaging with a big fizzy beer?
Yeah, I would take the same tack essentially that brewers do when they brew German Hefeweizens. You know, they have, instead of the usual, you know, 2.5, 2.6 volumes of CO2 that a normal sort of, you know, pale ale would have, porter, whatever. Those beers have, you know, maybe 3, 4, and 5 volumes of CO2, and they, you know, a lot of times they get packaged in those 500 mil bottles that, you know, the commercial Hefeweizens come in, and that would be a good way to do it. And then, you know, in order to get the right carbonation level, you have to look up a chart of whatever you fermented the beer at, whatever temperature, that'll tell you how much residual CO2 you have, and then you look at a second chart, and that will tell you, you know, how much sugar you need to add to reach whatever level of carbonation you want. And of course, these tables can be found at beerandwinejournal.com.
Yet another plug. Yeah. but if you're kegging, did you just pressurize it at a higher rate?
Yeah, all you'd have to do is look up that Zam and Nagel chart, where it has, you know, temperature the beer is stored at, the pressure the beer is stored under, and then, you know, you find the find the level of carbonation you want and turn it up. And the other thing you'd need is you're going to need to compensate on the dispense side, because if you use your normal, you know, length line leading out to your beer, but it's under twice as much pressure as normal, when you open the tap, it's going to spray all over like a fire hose. A tasty, tasty fire hose.
I'll leave that one alone.
Is it 5 o'clock yet? No, it's going to, you're going to, the beer's going to come out, and there's not going to be enough restriction in the line to slow it down to a reasonable range. So you're going to have to figure out ahead of time, you know, how much length to add to your beer dispensing line and do that. But there are, you know, there are online ways to look that up. Sadly, not at beer and wine.
That's too much like math.
Too much like math. It's that you, for the various different internal diameters of tubing, they have a certain amount of resistance. And then you, whatever pressure the beer is at, you have to counter that with resistance from the tube. And so it's the resistance of the tubing times the length of the tubing gives you some figure, and that figure needs to be whatever the pressure of the, you know, beer is coming out minus however much pressure you want shooting out of the tap. You know, if you adjusted it to zero, like theoretically the beer would go all the way down the tube and stop. But if you, you know, then have an extra 2 PSI, it'll be coming out at 2 PSI, you know, in theory.
And it seems like this would be a style that would lend itself to dry hopping. We didn't talk about dry hopping specifically.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the major features of the beer, is that it's the hop aroma is supposed to be, you know, very, very prominent or whatever. So dry hopping would be a great option for this, or even you could even try making hop extract. It's a little more involved, but you know, boil some water or very, very, very dilute wort, put some hops in it, let it steep for a while, press that off, and you know, add to your fermenter and let it work off whatever that last little bit of wort. And then, you know, you could also use just hop extracts. They sell not so much at the homebrew scale, but you know, they sell extracts of hop oils, and that would be a good beer to use that in.
And it'll be about 10 minutes before somebody comes up with a brute coffee beer, coffee IPA, and a brute Ben and Jerry's ice cream IPA, and so I'm sure there are going to be offshoots of this style to come. You know, which is always a good thing. It's always a good thing, except in your eyes, in the case of the New England IPAs.
Yeah, actually, the brute coffee beer that got me thinking. That'd be like essentially an extra dry stout. That could be good. I mean, you could think about that.
We'll see there. And yeah, there's time between now and you know, HomebrewCon. So, you know, homebrewers, there's your challenge. I expect to walk around club night and find a brute coffee IPA.
And then the makers of New England IPA can curse me for having such a bastardized style. I can't believe he brews that crap. Unless he brews lazy, crappy beers like we do.
Let it be on the record that I like the New England IPAs, and I'm enjoying the cloudy beers, and I'm trying to brew some. So there, just point counterpoint. Chris, you ignorant slut. If you remember that one, you're old like us.
Serve me right, because I'm sure at some point someone will hand me a New England IPA that actually tastes good. And I'll go, hey, I like this. And then everyone will go, huh? But until then, I will continue with my irrational prejudice.
All right. Well done, sir. And yeah, this is another beer to put on the list. And I will be looking for, you know, Brute IPAs, like I say, at HomebrewCon in June. So thank you, sir.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. And we will talk to you after the June break.
Okie dokie.
Well, thanks again to Chris. Yet another beer to put on the list to brew. Be sure to check out Chris's articles on beerandwinejournal.com and pick up a copy of the Homebrew Recipe Bible and Methods of Modern Homebrewing. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't tell us. Don't forget to tell us where you're from. You can tell us, please. Thanks to everybody supporting us. There are a Patreon page. Special goodies coming your way. Check all that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site. Get a free Basic Brewing bottle opener with any DVD combo. You can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store, too, as well as our logbooks where you can track and log up to 50 batches of beer. You get free stickers with every order at basicbrewingshop.com. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dotson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.